From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We are all taught the textbook chronology of how the United States marched into the Civil War. My guest today paints a larger canvas of passions and polarization and personalities, a cultural history of the war years and the furies before, during, after. It resonates today, this hour on Point, American Passions and the American Civil War. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do our passions today echo theirs? Have we safely moved on, grown up? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from New York is Brenda Wineapple. She teaches in the MFA programs at the New School University and Columbia University, professor of modern literary and historical studies at Union College. Her big new book is Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. Publishers Weekly calls it revelatory. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Brenda Wineapple, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks, Tom.
Your title is going to turn a lot of heads right away, and of course it goes back to Emily Dickinson. Give us the context. Ecstatic Nation. How did she use it? What do you mean by putting it up top of your book?
Well, first of all, I wanted to intrigue you. Second of all, it is from Dickinson in a wonderful poem that begins, "The heart is the capital of the mind." And although Dickinson is talking about internal processes, she really is talking about something larger, something wider, something in the country that I thought was captured by the word ecstatic because it meant joyful and promise and positive and exuberance. But there's also another side of it. There's a kind of frenetic quality and there's a kind of delirium that is implied by ecstasy. And it seemed to me that that covered an entire 30-year period where so much was going on. I didn't want a title that reduced the period to one line or to one point of view.
We want to look at a lot of those facets. They are so mm-hmm. rich here and so intriguing. But I guess by the end of the book, I took you to mean in part mm-hmm. Ecstatic Nation. Yes, in exactly that sense, almost of a berserker, like a nation that was had to prove it was willing to go berserk over its passions practically.
Well, yeah, I suppose that's true, and in a very tragic way, as well as a very unusual and even wonderful way, because the wonder is that finally slavery was eradicated. It was more than the Emancipation Proclamation. The 13th Amendment got rid of something that had been part of the country since its very founding. So that was the liberation part of ecstatic. But you're right. So much was going on, and there were so many factions, so much passion, so much feeling, so much excitement, so much promise. And that, too, was part of the nation before, during, and after the war.
Brenda Wineapple takes her title from Emily Dickinson. It's 1875, writing in that poem, concluding one. And I've never heard her or read her quite so Whitman-esque as this, but one is the population numerous enough. This ecstatic nation, seek it is yourself. We contain multitudes practically there and ecstasy too. Can we start very far from what seems like battlefields here? I mean, you take this canvas way out with people like P.T. Barnum, for heaven's sakes, as somehow, I don't know if instrumental or what, or Jenny Lind from my hometown in Bloomington, Illinois, the Swedish Nightingale. What on earth does a circus guy and a stage singer, maybe melodramatics, but beautiful stage singer, have to do with a nation going to war?
Well, it wasn't going to war at the time, and I don't think people thought that war was even possible, which is perhaps a kind of delusion. But P.T. Barnum, Jenny Lind, means promotion. There was a lot of promotion, self-promotion. That's what links Barnum, say, you mentioned, to Whitman. Whitman says, I contain multitudes, and so did Barnum in his American Museum. He had all kinds of creatures and people and
exhibits. Kind of permanent freak show in New York that made a fortune for him.
Yes, it did. And so did Jenny Lind. I mean, he was the promoter of that particular tour. And he took her as far across the United States as he could. And he's making a lot of money at that time. But he's also bringing crowds together in a certain sense. So there was a sense in that particular case of exuberance. And also, he was the proverbial self-made man. He came from Connecticut and he, you know, worked in various things, newspaper editor. He was a sales clerk. He was a circus promoter. And then he bought and created this museum and continued to promote. And in a sense, that's what America was about at the time. It was a sense of promise that you could create opportunities for yourself and you could also create needs in other people and that you could bring together rich and poor and men and women. And that's what he did. And that's what he exploited, too, at the same time. Whitman is the positive side of that. And Whitman actually met P.T. Barnum and interviewed him, which is wonderfully interesting. You don't think of these people together, but you realize they're part of the same historical moment.
Walt Whitman, of course, in that promotional vein, began writing. Emerson, I think you remind us, read his stuff, sent him a very nice glowing note. Walt Whitman plastered Emerson's comments as a blurb all over his
big, in the newspapers.
If
that
Emerson isn't
Barnum-esque, what is it? Not too happy at all. He was sending a private letter, and Whitman said, okay, this is a great, what we call today, blurb, and he used it. And he wasn't shy about doing it, and he called himself the greatest American poet. And you can think to the future, where, you know, you have Barnum and Bailey in the greatest show on earth, and everything is the greatest, the biggest, the most wonderful. And Whitman is part of that, too, and that's what makes his poetry today, even today, so wonderfully expansive, and it does embrace everyone if you get with his program.
So here they are embodying and channeling this promotion, this exuberance, mm-hmm. bringing out crowds. Mm-hmm. Of right. course, if you put a dark cast on it, that's, in a way, what war does as well. Conflict.
Bring out crowds.
Mobs. Well, and exuberance to the point of...
Hysteria.
Hysteria.
Yeah, and that's what's terribly frightening. And then you see that before, during, and after the war, too. You see it in vigilance committees that were formed in, especially after 1850, in the North, to help fugitive slaves evade the slave owners that were coming all the way north to recapture them. So people in that sense were taking the law into their own hands, and it became more and more extreme. The extreme case of that, of course, is John Brown, who mm-hmm. thinks he's going to start a slave insurrection, gathers together people. And the results in many ways are tragic. Innocent people are always killed in a situation like that. And then you see it in the Wide Awakes, that group of young men who march for and promote Lincoln when Lincoln's running in 1860. I mean, these are, from the vantage point of the 21st century, these are scary groups because they create a kind of mob mentality. Whether you agree with what they're doing, which is making sure that fugitive slaves find freedom, or you disagree with what they're doing when you see people coming in from Missouri to Kansas to prevent Kansas from voting against slavery. So it's frightening. It really is frightening to stand back and watch it, especially to know what's coming.
You say it's frightening as a historian when you know what's coming. But what about, I mean, in those couple of decades before the Civil War, did Americans sense, did they articulate that they were collectively getting awfully amped up in maybe lots of ways and ultimately some of them very dangerous? Did they have a sense of, oh my gosh, we're getting sort of a little crazy here?
Well, I don't think they saw themselves as getting crazy. We see themselves as getting crazy. They often lost rationality, but their arguments took them to the irrational in a certain sense. So they didn't, I think, understand that when they boosted the volume, when they got amped up, that there were consequences to the heated and passionate and martial rhetoric that they were using, and that the consequences were, in fact, war. But I don't think anybody really imagined that that was going to happen. And when it did seem imaginable, it still seemed to many Southerners, oh, the Northern, you know, the North would cave, something like that. Or the Northerners thought, oh, it'll be a short war. So nobody really could conceive of what was going to happen, which was mass slaughter, really.
And, of course, here we are in another time of passionate, heated, I mean, sometimes, you know, kind of martial-sounding rhetoric again. And people are ready to say they're worried about this sometimes. Does that worry seem justified to you, having looked so closely at the cultural history of this time, Brenda? Or, no, we're at a different time, a different level.
Well, I think, you know, to a certain extent, it does seem worrisome. I mean, many people have said to me, and you're implying too, that this kind of impassioned rhetoric leads to violence. But I'm not sure that it necessarily does, because we do have the lessons of history behind us.
Brenda Wineapple's wonderful new book is Ecstatic Nation. We'll look further. The Hutchinson Family Singers were the most popular American entertainers of the 1840s, part of her survey. Many of their songs directly promoted abolitionism, workers' rights, women's rights. Here's their pro-emancipation song, Get Off the Track, performed by the modern band Marley's Ghost. This is On Point.
Hear the mighty car wheels humming. Now look out, the engine's coming. Church and statesmen, hear the thunder. Clear the track, you'll all fall under. Get off the track, get off the track, get off the track. All are singing while the Liberty Bell is ringing. Roll it along through the nation, freedom's car, emancipation.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the passions and polarization that drove America to civil war and beyond. My guest is Brenda Wineapple, author of the wonderful new book, Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Brenda Wineapple quotes Ralph Waldo Emerson saying, America is the country of the future. There was so much brimming optimism in so many ways. Writing, it is a country of beginnings, of projects, of designs, and expectations. But she writes, the present then, this is before the Civil War, was and the future would be also a time of delirium, failure, greed, violence, and refusal to listen and to find or create the common, hard common ground of compromise, refusal to bend. Compromise is something you pay a lot of attention to and the lack thereof and how people looked at it in these years. Brenda, take us to some of that.
I do, and I'm still fascinated by it. You know, it's a word that's come into the current lexicon, too. Who's going to compromise? Should compromise be a good thing? Is compromise appeasement? Is it giving up? Is it a pragmatic solution? And when you think of American history, and you actually think the language of it starts in, you know, much earlier, but in my period, you have the Compromise of 1850, which was supposed to keep a balance between slave and free when you got all the land acquired by the United States after the Mexican War. Mm-hmm. And you go all the way up to 1877 in what's called the Compromise of 1877. So the word was something that was there in the period, and it was fun, actually, in a grim sort of way to tease it out, to find that William Lloyd Garrison was saying, we will not compromise with tyranny, and burnt the Constitution, because he felt that the Constitution was a compromised document. And yet, without some kind of compromise, without creating some kind of bridge between polarized and dissenting points of view, that you couldn't have any kind of movement toward liberation, say, freedom for many people, for whatever idealistic project that you want, and for making the country a more perfect union, which is, in a sense, what Lincoln was about. In a way, he understood, I think, the nature of compromise and was trying to take it away, you know, sort of burnish it to make it work again and make it not seem like a cheap trick.
But there was
compromise.
But there was, and you illustrate this in so many ways. This, at the same time, this almost to your word, ecstatic impulse, to follow the conflict just as deep and hard as it would go, to make it, you know, millennial almost. I mean, and you, mm-hmm. you interpret, you find this even in the pages of Melville's Moby Dick. You've got, you put Ahab and Starbuck in opposition there around, will we be, you know, crusaders or pragmatists, practical here.
Exactly, exactly. And Ahab, who is willing to take down a whole ship, a crew, a group of people with him to fight to vanquish Moby Dick and what Moby Dick means to him, to the extent that he sees all the evil and all the wrong and all the horror of the world in this one whale, in this one symbolic whale. He is an idealist, but he's also an absolutist. And Starbuck comes along and says, whoa, wait a minute, you know, why are you going after this dumb brute that didn't do anything to you, you know, that didn't intend to do anything to you? Let's try to make a workaround. But Starbuck is vanquished. He doesn't have enough strength. And Ahab is vanquished too, but Ahab takes everyone with him. And in a sense, Starbuck is problematic as well because he doesn't have the strength to stop Ahab.
So what's the parallel you're drawing there to civil war issues or deep national conflict?
Well, the deep national conflict is those absolutists, in a sense, in the South and in a way in the North, too. Although the abolitionists are fighting for what they believe is a moral right. And Lincoln believes in that moral right, but he wants to work through what we'd call today channels. And in a sense, at the time, there were many, you know, abolitionists who thought that he was compromising, that he was slow, that he was retarded in the way that he wanted to address the great wrong of the nation. And then in the South, you had what was called the fire eaters. And that's very Ahab-like, too, who wanted to secede. They almost wanted to secede no matter what. And they really felt that they were protecting the Constitution and that they were the ones who were protecting the country because the country was founded in such a way that it allowed them what they considered to be liberty. So no one was listening to one another, and it was almost a downward slide. I don't want to say it was inevitable, but you can see that that there was a way in which perhaps unconsciously both sides were you know, cruising for a bruising, basically.
You go way back in that apprehension of the bruising, ultimately the Civil War, to Thomas Jefferson, who, you know, for all of his role in helping come up with the Constitutional Three-Fifths and the rest, had a very, very deep, bad feeling about this compromise around slavery. But more broadly, when did the country begin to say, feel, demonstrate that it knew it was playing with fire here? Was it all through this period, or did that sense, my God, we're playing with fire?
Well, it became more and more extreme during the period. And I think that, you know, that's why they begin the book with the death of John Quincy Adams. Mm-hmm. He's the last link to the founding fathers. And with his death, we realize we're really in a different era. We've acquired an enormous amount of land, as I said before. Mm-hmm. Quincy Adams was against the Mexican War. He had a sense, like Jefferson too, that the country really needed to reckon with its failure to live up to its promise, particularly in the matter of slavery. And one of the last words he said, he died in the House of Representatives, which seemed fitting to many people and probably to himself. One of the last words he said was no. It was a refusal, and he didn't want to make Mexican War veterans heroes because he thought that that was damaging, and he thought that that would create a kind of, you know, a voracious appetite for more land, more slaves, more, you know, more of the moral wrongs that he had begun to fight against. And at that particular point, I think that with his death and the so-called compromise and the fugitive slave law, which came with the compromise, that at that particular point, the country began to become much louder, more exuberant in the one sense of its optimism and its idealism, but it's more the more entrenched forces of let's keep things the way they are, protect the Constitution as it is. Those two things dug in as well.
Whitman celebrated that exuberance. You quote Henry David Thoreau just going the other way, saying, what is there in the people? Pshaw, what do you see in all this cheating, political corruption? Disdain.
Yeah, and Whitman saw the disdain, but he was a man who saw, you know, the glass half full. Thoreau was much more solitary. He was much more a kind of libertarian, we'd almost call him today. But at the same time, he was staunchly moral, as was Whitman. And he's the one who wrote the essay that we so often quote all through the 20th century and the 21st, Civil Disobedience. And for him, it was important to protest against the wrongs of a government that he thought was tyrannical. And he did that. And civil disobedience, of course, means taking the full consequences. But Thoreau was much more of what Whitman Melville would call an isolado. He was by himself, and yet he would go to the abolitionist rallies. And during the one 1854, where Garrison burnt the Constitution, he too said he wouldn't follow the law anymore if the law was immoral.
Joan in Newton, Massachusetts is calling. Joan, you're on the air with Brenda Wineapple.
Hello. Yes, I was interested in knowing whether you have heard the name Anthony Benezet.
Anthony Benezet?
Yes, I have.
From the Quaker, the Quaker community?
He was a Quaker, and he, as far as I can tell, was single-handedly responsible for creating the abolitionist movement.
Well, he very well may have been. I don't know him. If he helped create or single-handedly created the abolitionist movement, it's hard to believe it was single-handed.
Yeah.
But if that were the case, then it would be even before the period we're discussing. You know, the Quakers were abolitionists or anti-slavery for a very, very long time. Sounds like an interesting man.
Lived until 1784, I see here, and you know, there's people talking about him as being part of that population that changed slavery from an everyday thing to a moral outrage. What about that rising sense of it? I mean, you quote Lincoln ultimately saying, when the white man governs himself, that is self-government, but when he governs himself and also governs another man, that is more than self-government, that is despotism. That other man being the Negro, as Lincoln
said.
That's
right. That's right. And Lincoln was very firm about that. Those who saw, as I mentioned before, thought that he was dragging his feet in getting rid of slavery really didn't see the fact that he had always been against it. There was no way he wanted to keep the institution, but he was a man of law, and when he was first elected, he promised to keep the law as it was. It didn't mean that he was going, you know, that he wasn't going to try to change it, but he was saying to the South, which was horrified by his election, he was saying, you know, I'm going to protect you. I don't want the extension of slavery, but we're going to protect it where it is.
What about the Quakers? And for that matter, the Mormons you make much of in your ecstatic nation of this middle of the 19th century.
Yeah, well, the Quakers were very much, as your caller said, abolitionists for sure. And there were quite a number of them very active in the 1850s. People we've heard about and people we haven't. I became also interested in the Mormons because it's so unusual when you think of an international religion that is popular today and important and powerful. It actually started in America. It started in upstate New York, moved out to the West, and became part of that Western movement that becomes important during the war and certainly after the war. Here we have an indigenous American religion that comes really for a while in conflict with the American government. Buchanan, the president, in the late 1850s, actually sent troops out because he was afraid that the Mormons were setting up a shadow government. And I realized that this, in some ways, is connected to the debates of Lincoln and Douglas, because the issue here is popular sovereignty. Can we vote the kind of government that we want to have? And can we vote for or against slavery? Can we vote, for example, not that the Mormons were overtly doing this, but can we vote for or against polygamy?
whatever we want. It's a free country, that notion.
It's a free country, yes, absolutely. And how free is free? And if it's completely free, are you free to secede? Lincoln, I think, brilliantly pointed out that the idea of secession would lead to anarchy because the seceded states, then some states could secede from those states. And then there could be, you know, secession ad infinitum. And Lincoln's point was that the Union was created before the Constitution and the Union preceded it and one could not secede. Seceding was against the law.
This notion of popular sovereignty still very, very much kind of running around through our conversation.
Absolutely.
Today.
Yeah.
And Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
This is a very engaging conversation. Very, very glad to be able to take part in it a little bit. Anthony Benezet, he was a Quaker. Yeah, he was inspired by Quakers. He was a Frenchman. He came in young. He was an activist. He was in Philadelphia. What he did was he inspired. He got around. He was like an evangelist in Philadelphia, and he really spread the abolitionist movement rather quickly. But that's not what I called the address.
Yes, sir.
I have Quakers in my family background. I also have a Confederate general in my background. And this was a war of secession. It wasn't actually a civil war per se, but a war of secession that might have become what you call a civil war. But I find this very engaging. I see the things going on today much like then, the hysteria that this author speaks of. I think you're very insightful, and I think to keep this discussion going is very important and valuable to this country right now because when you look back at that time, there are so many parallels with what's going on today.
Bob, where do you see even hysteria today that you would identify as a cousin of something from that time, Bob?
Well, I'll give you one example, and then I'll give you another to kind of go off. What we know is the modern-day Tea Party is kind of interesting in that you have essentially a group of people that are put forward to protest against the government that sold out to corporations, but these people are essentially backed by that very same kind of right-wing corporate mode. So there's something that's completely disconnected and nonsensical at a time when there's a lot of issues that could be more like a real Tea Party issue, a real protest against corporate tyranny, such as cannabis prohibition. And it gets shoved under a rug because it's not convenient for the corporate media or the, you know.
There's one. You got another, Bob? We've just got a few seconds before the break.
Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's terrific to have you. Call again, Bob. I'm very happy to have you with us. There you've got a listener. We've got a listener in Oklahoma who sees parallels in hysteria. We don't want to draw them too closely, but this country can get riled up in its ecstasies.
Yes, absolutely. And in a sense, again, it's a mixed bag. It's a good thing and a bad thing. You want people riled up. You don't want apathy.
Yes, it's
you
a
want
democracy.
People engaged.
Care about
absolutely,
it. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you want people to be part of the democratic process. But that's part of the process. What we're talking to is moving outside the process and in many ways taking the law into your own hands for good and for evil. And it's evil's a strong word, but I think it's worth thinking about.
Brenda Wineapple's big new book is Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. Johnny Comes Marching Home, composed 1863, performed here by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. The Mormons were settling the West in the decades leading up to the Civil War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the passions and polarization that drove America to civil war and beyond all those decades ago. Brenda Wineapple writes about that time on a huge cultural canvas, brings in all kinds of angles you may never have related to the Civil War in her terrific new book, Ecstatic Nation. She joins us today from New York City. Lots of response online, Brenda. Kevin's looks back then, and what he sees is a political ineptitude, lack of spine, and federal overreach, says, just like right now. Christine writes to us, says she was at the Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois. Mm. She says, such a small crowd for such a stunningly emotional museum there. She writes, I sadly think that our nation is so divided once again, she says, by Fox and Rush and all the evil sayers, half our nation would not set foot in this most gorgeous museum. Well, I don't know. David writes, I'm amazed that Union has survived this long. People still wondering. Jeff in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, you're on the air with Brenda Wineapple.
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to make the point that I feel we can draw a lot of parallels with that today because compromise has become a dirty word, and especially with the Tea Party or the hard right. You know, if you compromise, then you're going to be voted out of office. And in some circles, I've even heard people talk seriously about secession. Whether that's a reality or not, I don't know. But it's I can't help but feel like we're definitely disconnected here in the you know, so-called flyover states as opposed to the coast. I definitely feel like there's an ideological divide that probably existed in 1840 and 1850.
Boy, let's hope it's not that deep, but we know it's very real, and I take your assessment, Jeff, and I appreciate your call. Let's get another angle on it, if I may. Richard in East Killingly, Connecticut. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just read the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant.
Yes.
And he says the Civil War, or the war between the states, wouldn't have taken place if it weren't for the cotton gin. Now, the cotton gin made it possible for slave owners to have more territory, more slaves. It's a little bit like taking computers away from Bill Gates.
Hmm.
They were looking for more power, and the Eastern establishment was looking to essentially limit them. And that's one of the things I got from his memoirs. Beyond that, the problem today is also technological. We need fewer people to produce incredible amounts of stuff with computers, robots, and outsourcing. We're going to have problems here no matter what. So I believe the problem is about the same. And we have to make some kind of adjustments to find out what to do with people.
Well, you raised two big ones and good ones, and I appreciate your call, Richard. Brenda, how about it? First, on this the economics interest front, which comes down to this question of dominance. What culture, what region will dominate? You certainly had plenty of people, not least in the North, saying, you know what, no small part of this moral indignation is tied up with economic interests.
Right, absolutely. I think Emerson said that the American flag is sewn with cotton threads, and Bronson Alcott wouldn't wear cotton because obviously it came from the South. The caller, Richard, I think, who mentions the cotton gin and talks about technology, I think makes a wonderful point. Absolutely. The ability to harvest and expand the cotton empire was enormously important. I think economics and slavery went hand in hand. But the North we shouldn't, you know, divide too rigidly North from South, because the North had interests,
absolutely,
commercial interests in the South.
That's, lay those out, those ecstatic interests.
Yeah, and, you know, the Northern factories, many of the Northern factories that were booming in Massachusetts, Lawrence Lowell, say, in other parts of the Northeast were dependent on getting cotton from the South. So that not everybody in the North by any means was an abolitionist. Not everybody in the North was anti-slavery. Certainly there were many people who wanted to keep things as they were. But technology is very important in this particular period of time because, first, you have, Grant is right, the cotton gin, but don't forget the railroads are important in terms of developing commerce. And, you know, part of what Stephen Douglas, who fought against Lincoln, who ran against Lincoln, was, you know, part of his program was getting a railroad through Illinois so that the country was both coming together and dividing at the same time. And that was a function of technology, for sure.
And what about, our caller points to this intersection of technology and labor. You know, it was what labor is going to be deployed where, and who will profit from it with new technologies coming on the scene. I mean, people are talking these days, just in the Times over the weekend, about computers making the middle class obsolete.
Right.
I mean, tensions rise in those huge displacement moments.
Absolutely. Tensions rise and people are exploited. There's no, or people are the victims in a sense. That's too strong a word. But, you know, I think, one thing I put in the book was, something called the Pemberton disaster. It happened in Lawrence, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And at the time, it was the worst industrial disaster in the country.
Sort of like the Bangladesh disaster we saw not long ago. Collapsing.
Very much like
what?
Rana
Describe
Plaza.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And what happened is that the managers of Pemberton Mills were putting too much heavy equipment. And finally, the floors collapsed, and the whole thing imploded, and people were mangled and burned. And it was really, really, really dreadful. And when I read about the debates over what had happened in the Congressional Globe, what was interesting was that many of Southern congressmen were saying, we treat our slaves much better than you in the North treat your workers because they're not protected at all. There are no labor laws whatsoever. And you realize that here we have an intersection of technology, commerce, and yet once again a moral issue, which is slavery.
You know, there was a sense, of course, even at the time, and you close with the very active abolitionist outside of Boston, Wayland, Lydia Maria Child, telling friends, and she'd been such a spark plug on that, telling her friends that she wanted carved on her tombstone, this very passionate woman of the 19th century, you think us dead. We are not dead. We are the living. And then, of course, you remind us Faulkner comes along with the echoes this. The past is never dead. It's not even past.
Right.
I mean, did the people of that time think these passions would subside, go away?
I think
away?
They were hoping they were, and that was the election of Rutherford B. Hayes. That was what was called the Compromise of 1877. Hayes would promise to pull out all the troops, the Northern troops, you know, Union troops, Army troops, out of the South, so it will not be militarized anymore. The South could then become more autonomous again without the intervention of the government, and that presumably everyone would clasp hands. That was Horace Greeley. His run for president, that was his slogan, and everything would be peaceful and calmer. That was, I think, a surface solution, and I think people like Lydia Maria Child knew it, and when she said, we are not the dead, meaning that our moment hasn't passed, we are the living, because the ideas that we believed in and that we fought for...
Freedom, equality...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And they're going to still be with us, and we're still going to fight for them. Maybe not on the battlefield. We hope not on the battlefield, because we saw 750,000 men were killed, and that's probably that's probably not even the number. It's probably larger than that. But we are going to go on. We are going to protect voting rights. We are going to protect citizenship. We're going to grant citizenship to all people. We are going to give women the vote. We are going to continue with what we believe. We are the living. And I mean, I found that very moving.
I mean, so she thought, but of course we went into the Jim Crow era. A lot of that didn't happen. You had John Greenleaf Whittier. You quote, oh boy, he was aging at this point. He had been, you know, big in the abolitionist
As a Quaker,
right?
Yeah.
But then you quote him saying that at last the Negro will disappear from the field of national politics. This is in The Nation, wrote. Henceforth, the nation as a nation will have nothing to do with him. The time had come for consolidation. You write, big business, a nation appeased and united in the pursuit of wealth and forgetfulness, secure nonetheless that it had once fought with ecstatic might for freedom and fairness. Was there a kind of sense of satisfaction? Well, it was bloody, it was horrible, but we took our convictions absolutely to the full extreme. We were willing to be...
I think people want to forget. I think it was devastating. I think that people want to put the war behind. They want to move on. They want to deny. They want to forget. And to a certain extent, it's human. It's understandable. They wanted to look toward the future and put the past to rest. But as you quote Faulkner, the past is never dead. And he's talking about, it's not even past. He's talking about excuse me, the South, certainly, and it wasn't passed in the West. It wasn't passed anywhere except that the American rhetoric is we live in the present and we're going to make the present the be-all and end-all. It wasn't for everyone. And but that, I think, was the rhetoric and that was the desire to move away from the tragedy and the brutality and the butchery, really, that was war.
Danny in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. Danny, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I thought I heard you say at the beginning of the program, I thought I heard you mention Red Cloud.
Yes, I did.
Okay. How does he figure into this whole story?
Well, bear in mind that Brenda's huge canvas stretches on both sides of the Civil War, and it stretches from the Mason-Dixon out into the West. But I'm glad you raised it. Brenda, take us into that part of the canvas, Red Cloud, and that part of your story.
Well, citizenship is important, and the issues of race extend not just to black, but to certainly to Native Americans. One of the questions that I had when I was working on this book is there a relationship between Reconstruction, because we think of Reconstruction, the period after the war, mm-hmm. as pertaining to the South. But what about the West? The West was being settled. We mentioned the Mormons before. There was the Gold Rush of 1848. The railroads were extending west. There was a Transcontinental Railroad in 1869. What's going on there? And you realize that many of the soldiers of the war from the North, like, say, Sherman or Sheridan or Custer, they went out west. And what were they doing? They were making the West safe for white settlers, very often at the expense of the indigenous people who lived there. Red Cloud then comes in as a Lakota chief, mm-hmm. comes into my book, as one who is protesting what is happening to his and other peoples, the decimation of the food supply, which was the buffalo, the thrusting of peoples into reservation, the breaking of treaties. He, Red Cloud, came all the way east. He went to Washington, and he met with what he called the gray men, and he went to New York City. He spoke at Cooper Union. He was looking for a way to preserve peace and land for his people.
All part of the story of these decades. Sonia in South Hero, Vermont. Sonia, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to go back for a second to the connection between today and the Civil War. Mm-hmm. More specifically, how today we're starting to get a greater fear of the national government encroaching on our lives, and how the South, when they seceded, were very afraid of the national government coming in and infringing upon their states' rights. So I just wanted to know what you guys had to say about that.
Brenda, I'll let you pick it up with it wherever you like to take it.
Well, the North encroaching on the government, again, part of what was happening, part of the rhetoric, the heated rhetoric of the South, was that you're coming, you're going to take our way of life away. That, again, when Lincoln was elected, he was very clear. He was saying, no, I'm not going to do that. But I think the South actually believed that it was being contained. And we're getting, if you forgive the word, paranoid about what was going on, because they, I think, at some level knew that their system, slavery, the institution of it, was really doomed, and it was headed toward extension if they didn't have the safety valve of expanding in the West or even in the South to the Caribbean, and that was being cut off for them. So it wasn't as if the North was coming in with troops or encroaching or taking over in any way, but I think in terms internally, they knew that something was imploding in their own system.
All right, now we put you in the role of Oracle. Brenda, are we a better, wiser, more mature nation today?
Well, we don't have slavery anymore, at least not institutionalized. So I think, yeah, we're better. I think that there's a way in which many people try to learn from the past. I think the caller that talked about weak executives or strangleholds in Congress, we didn't even talk about that as a, you know, as a correlate to what happened in the 19th century. All those things, we have to look back in history as warnings. Yeah, in many ways, we're better. We have more freedoms. We do have the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. Women have the vote. Absolutely. But it doesn't mean that progress is a straight line or that that we should paper over the very real divisions that many of your callers talked about and the very real acrimony with which we sometimes talk to each other and fail to listen.
Brenda Wineapple, author of the really wonderful new book, Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. It will take you on a big journey if you pick it up. Brenda, it's wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you very much. Thanks for all this work. It's just terrific. Thank you.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine. Thank you for your good questions and conversation.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We'll go out with little Aaron Copland. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.